Hello listeners, thank you for tuning in. My guest for today is Aishwarya Gupta and he has over a decade of experience in sales and marketing. He started his career as a technical sales engineer and has now emerged as a product leader for building sustainable solutions in the digital agriculture space. He's also part of the core strategy team that drives innovation at Bosch. I've had the opportunity to work closely with him at Bosch, especially in the realm of conceptualizing, formulating and driving SaaS products. His experience is very vast as he has spread his tentacles in sales and marketing, IT strategy, design thinking and branding. Interesting fact, he runs his own podcast that's called The Thinking Psychologist. So Ash, welcome to the Elbow Grease podcast.
Thanks for inviting me, Sharad.
Anytime. So I wanted to start with the Bosch India Innovation Award that you won for True Food Plus. Can you explain a bit about that, Ash?
You see, in Bosch, you know, we both know that they're trying to change themselves more towards an AI, IoT-based company from traditional manufacturing, right? And within that stream, one of the search fields was food and agriculture. So I was tasked to develop something in the technology space where we can develop a solution which is focused towards provenance. Okay, so provenance is all about where my food is coming from. It is sustainably sourced, ethically grown, and everything. So here, you know, here the idea was to get something up and running really fast, get it validated from the market that there is actually a need out there in the market. Like one of the people from Lean Canvas called Ash Moria says that life is too short to build a product that nobody wants. So you see, with that ethos in mind, innovation that I took the approach was to do paper selling first, create a hypothesis, go out there, meet real customers, try to sell them, and then once I see, you know, a customer hesitating or putting in new points, quickly, you know, pivot my hypothesis, create a new hypothesis, a modified and a better version, take them again, and then validate. So what has happened is that we were able to do a lot of validation, hypothesis validation, create a fantastic narrative, take it out there and get real customer conversations and sales done. And just on the paper without even building the product. So the benefit that the management got out of it was mostly towards removing the uncertainty of developing a product. Now that the uncertainty is removed, the management can go and invest heavily into a product which is already validated, and now they see that if I invest heavily into it, this product is 100% gonna succeed, which traditionally doesn't happen in the product companies where the product is built first and then it's taken into the market to validate and sell. So that is how True Food Plus was very different, and that's what I believe has fetched the Bosch India Innovation Award, and I see a bright future for True Food Plus.
Great. So to ask you this question, Ash, which is, how do you find what spaces to go after, especially in the innovation realm, right? So True Food Plus, I understand completely you're trying to revolutionize the food industry, also revolutionize the supply chain space with block kind of the amount of effort that you've put over there, and it's not that easy. So how do you understand, how do you look for those white spaces to go after, especially in the realm of innovation?
See, you know, first of all, let's try to understand the definition of innovation, and then from a broader view, we can, you know, drill down deeper into the topic. So innovation if I have to say innovation just coming from MIT, so innovation is equal to invention plus commercialization. Okay. So it's not something very new that you invent, but the idea that you are behind should be commercialized and can be scaled up. Okay. So now to find a new problem out there, okay, so there has to be a need out there. And then there are certain parameters of the problem or the need. So to give you an example, there are 6 parameters of any problem out there. If you pick up any startup who's solving a novel problem or True Food Plus or any product that you pick up, the future of the dimensions of the problem they are trying to solve can be bifurcated into these 6 buckets. Okay, the first is it a popular problem? Okay, so you know everybody wants a shirt, so it's a popular problem. there's going to be need for shirts out there in the market. Then second thing would be, is it a frequent problem? Do you want a shirt twice a day, thrice a day, or once a month? So you want to look at problems which are very frequent. Third thing is, it should be an urgent problem. So, you know, if the problem is urgent, then the solutions required, the demand for the solution by the people who have that problem will be quite increased as compared to the problems which are not. The fourth dimension is, it should be an expensive problem. So for example, if I talk about an expensive problem, you know, during the lockdown and, you know, mates not coming in. So it was a frequent problem. It was an expensive problem and it was a tedious problem. So then the fourth dimension is the expensive problem, and the companies like to solve expensive problems. Then there is, the majority wants it. It's a growing problem and the majority wants it. So that's a fifth and sixth. So if you look at any problem in the innovation space before you start, we have to form an hypothesis around the dimension that we want to go, and then define the problem under these six dimensions. And look at that, you know, is these dimensions of problem the solver, how many am I able to tick mark? And while we were looking at True Food Plus into the food domain, it was ticking off almost four of these dimensions, out of six. So that is where, you know, the whole idea of looking at a search field. So the search field is defined by the management, and our job is to go behind, inside the search field, find the areas where there is a burning problem, and, you know, fitting these six value statements. So that's how innovation actually is working, and all the startups are being evaluated on that base on the search. So just to give you a brief idea here.
Great. Now, that makes me ask another question, which is, to understand whether the problem is expensive or whether there is an actual need for the problem or not, or whether it's scalable, which is the growth, is what most companies are after. I think a lot of math-based decision, or which we all euphemistically call today as data-driven decisions, have to be made. So I think analytics is a most important function when you make that decision, right? Do you look at some of the key metrics and also say, okay, maybe we should go after this, maybe we should go after an X product, maybe we should go after a Y product? Do you use some of the analytics functions as well to validate your hypothesis? Obviously, it has to be data driven, right? At the end of the day.
So, you know, generally talking about the professional world and how we, you know, because I have been into the innovation field for more than 10 years now. So, you know, because before this particular role, I was with a startup for, you know, about 3 years, and we scaled that startup from 20 people to 200 people. So, So then that, you know, again, developing new weather-based products around about the, you know, crop insurance, weather forecasting. Basically, I was selling clouds. So, you know, coming to the question that you have asked is about how do I utilize data to drive my decisions into looking at the world. Is there a product market fit for my products out there or not? So first up is, there is this particular theory about innovations, which is called crossing the chasm, and it is from one of the MIT researchers, and it talks about how different organizations fail or different products fail in an innovation journey. So what kind of data we use a sort of a combination of primary and secondary research together at a very, very early stage of product development. We use tools to look at a particular segment. So, for example, let's talk about food only over here. Before we even started this journey, we were looking at the global maturity of all the top 500 organizations playing in the food domain. And then once we were looking at that, what parameters are we looking at? So in this particular context, we were looking at blockchain. So there were five parameters that we were looking at. Has this organization implemented any blockchain use case? So we would give them a certain rating accordingly. We would say that, you know, has this organization got a blockchain team inside their organization? We were looking at, have one of the representatives from this organization participated in any blockchain event over there? Do we see large, you know, events being conducted or being participated by this organization which are related into the field of AI and blockchain? So you see, once you provide a grading and rating on all these parameters which are coming from the secondary sources, You get an idea about which of customers are mature, which customers are not mature, and what kind of use cases they are implementing in the industry. And that gives you a very broad view of your customer personas as well as the use cases. So you've already solved the two pieces of the puzzle, that the industry is moving towards a particular use case, and these are the kind of personas that are trying to solve it, and that are trying to use cases with the persona that are trying to do it. Now that you have that particular data, you look at what regions are sparking up for that particular use case. Then you look towards the region. So for example, the GTM that we had is about US and Europe for TrueFood Plus. So the regions which are sparking up have a burning problem. And that is why these use cases are emerging. And then the third space is to look at the competition, develop a hypothesis, and start your work from there once your primary and secondary research is completed on the basis of the data. Along with it, it is also complemented with, you know, a lot of market research along with it. So we look at a lot of Gartner and Frost and Sullivan kinds of reports in order to validate, are we going in the right direction or not?
Right. So there's a lot of market research involved even before you go after these white spaces. That's great. So as you rightly said, artificial intelligence, machine learning, blockchain, all these are new topics, not just for us, but even for the customers that we are going to talk to. Right. So in that realm, there's an old adage, of course, the customer is always right. So how do you deal with that when you go and speak to a particular customer or their industry who hasn't implemented or even taken up artificial intelligence or even gone through a blockchain transformation? How do you educate them?
Yeah, interesting question. So, you know, let me come here with an, you know, practical experience that I had with one of the customers. Okay, so yeah. Now we are into this. You know, we as Bosch are into artificial intelligence, IoT, and, you know, blockchain and any kind of a technology that you name. We are here for. I was interacting with one of the large global retailers, and this was in Europe, and the CEO and the CTO were in the room. Okay, and they know their business in and out, to tell you really. And right. They wouldn't expect any of the outsiders coming in with a suit and tie to come in and tell them that, you know, there are certain technologies that will change the way they are currently working.
Correct.
So my experience was that once the initial pitch that we did to them on how we can automate their shared business processes with blockchain and how, you know, the data collection can be automated via AI and IoT, they sort of understood the things. But the pushback that we received is that that you don't understand my business. How would you even implement IoT or AI? Okay,
right.
That is where the person who is sitting in front of you, you as a person who is sitting in front of them, has to do a lot of credibility building before even you set up go into the meeting. Now, once I talk about the credibility building, this is coming from the influence, the psychology of persuasion by Cialdini. Okay. So where he talks about is how you research before you go into a meeting. How you research about the person you're going to meet, and then you use the rule of likability to gain influence over him. So for example, Sharat, I study about you that you're a CTO of a large organization. You have been working in food industry, retail industry. I look at your profiles and what forums have you spoken in. And then once I'm having a conversation with you during a meeting, customer pitches, I try to bring in those elements that interest you. So I try to use my domain knowledge. I try to use my likability influence, as well as I try to show them the value proposition. So with any of the technology will only give you the value proposition of X number of savings you will receive. Second would be the painting a picture in the customer's mind about a new world that gets them excited. And the third piece, the piece of the puzzle that I think is the most important one, is the first one, to gain his trust. So first is gain his trust by saying that the person who was sitting in front of you is knowledgeable. Second is, yes, I am very likable person, because I understand where you come from, my interests are the same. And the third thing that we say is that I'm going to save you tons and tons of money if you utilize this new kind of solutions. And the fourth thing that I say is that, you know, I have already done it for X number of customers. Here's the proof. And that seals the deal, Sharat.
Absolutely. I love the answer that you gave. And I love that you completely predicated it on credibility. Trust is the most important factor, especially when you're going into a sales conversation, I believe, Ash.
Very much.
So yeah. In have you ever been in a situation where you knew that a potential customer is a great fit for our products and suddenly you were rejected? Were you in that situation?
Yeah, most of the time. Most of the time.
Walk us through some of the experiences that you've had.
So, you know, this is in UK again, one of the customers we were sitting with, and the early stages of our hypothesis validation. So, you know, we understood that, you know, this recall trend traceability is a huge problem for them. And we had established everything, you know, the credibility was established because of the Bosch brand name. My domain experience was speaking up, the likability thing was established. But sometimes what happens is cracking into a new customer or opening a new door is difficult because there are 10 different smarter sales guys who are already sitting there and they've got their pieces already established. So, you know, the most difficult part of cracking into a new customer is to understand who are the key people from your competitor organizations who are already in touch with the customers. Because they would have used the same principle, they would have had a good favorable relationship. And you would always like to work with a person whom you have already worked with. So, for example, we talk about getting our foot in the door, right? And so that once you get a foot in the door, you become, you know, convenient with that person, the dealings become easy and you know that organization and the person very well. So that's where, you know, setting the credibility and having a relationship beforehand is actually very important. And this is what has impacted any of the organizations, I would say, who want to venture into an Horizon 3 kind of an innovation. So Horizon 3 kind of innovation is about new markets in completely new areas. So not into traditional markets and new areas. It's a new market and new area. So for Bosch, food and agri is a new area and completely new markets. So that's a Horizon 3 kind of an innovation where the customer target market would be completely different from what has been existing. So that is where I have personally faced the challenges that we haven't been able to get our foot into the door because other people are already established over there. And then the resonance of your brand in that particular domain and already playing in that field is also very important. So for example, if I say that, you know, someone from Morgan Stanley or from, you know, Gartner is going to consult me. And then I say that, you know, on food topics, and then I say that, you know, management consulting will be done by Bosch. So already established player would get that edge, right? Because they are the consultancy expert and they have been in this field for a long time.
True.
So those are the challenges that we face, Sharat. You know, and that's one of the blockers that has led to, you know, most of the time the deal we have lost.
I completely understand. It's completely esoteric from what you're saying. Now, let's say you've gone ahead, you've cracked a customer, and they have at least given us a go to conduct a research, like a research project, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a paid POC, for example, which I've seen most of the times that we also get. So my observation is that you guys get us a project, get us a deal. And then a lot of product managers today that I have at least seen are great in building some of the great products. And they invest a lot of time in the build process.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, most of them do not know how to grow the product or just to scale that particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice do you have for us product managers, Ash? Because you put a lot of effort in bagging that deal. And when we come back to you and say, you know what, we don't know whether we can rightly scale this thing or not. How do you go back and convince the customer on those lines?
So, Sharat, you know, Facebook took 12 years to get 15 million, you know, people. Okay.
Right. Then, do we have that time?
Then I'll tell you what the example that I'm saying is. Then came the Instagram. It took 15 months. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
Then there was Angry Birds, which took about, say, you know, 1.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there was TikTok, which roughly hit it around 20 days. The point that I'm trying to make is that the traditional ways of building a product and the traditional ways our consumers have been, you know, consuming the product has drastically changed. So Even once we talk about the product development journey and having a lot of good product managers who would like to get in, develop new features and scale it up, it is very important to stay in the game and in the industry to understand what is happening out there. So what my recommendation to any of the product managers over there who want to scale up their products is to be with the customer and then look at what new features are there and how can I solve them the fastest. So that the number, the you know, what's it called in the digital and digital native age is that the the active users per day and per month. And that
the DAU and
exactly,
the
exactly.
MAU.
The number of active users, how is my customer interacting with my product? How can I make it easy? And what new features will complement it? And I believe on the existing feature set that is available with the product, it is fairly easy to get an advanced version faster as compared to building a new feature set and then getting it in. And you know, once you get a global customer for which the hypothesis is validated, I think it's very easy to scale it up. But again, the regional requirements vary. The political constraint, the rules and regulations, everything vary and have an impact on the feature set. That is why it is very important to align with the initial GTM plan when this product was being hypothesized as well. So that then you have the regional focus, then you have the product feature focus, and then once you have the product feature focus, then you prioritize based on the basis that what is the maximum value I can add. And then define your whole product development criteria on the basis of value. And I think that's the best way to scale your products.
I completely agree. Core product value, the way it resonates with your customer, I don't think the features that you put in, I look at them as cool bells and whistles. But I think the core product value is what speaks to the customer, as you rightly put it.
Definitely.
Now, I want to pivot a little and I want to ask you this question because we're in the COVID situation still. We're not out of it yet. So as a professional, especially in sales and marketing, you always have to be 30 seconds ahead. And I mean that figuratively. Looking for new prospects, building your pipeline. And the keystone here is consistency, Ash. I see a lot of effort that you guys put in and it's high pressure. How do you maintain that? Going into 2021, we have to build a pipeline of projects and we need to convert them. So how do you maintain that consistency going forward? What tips do you have?
You know, the COVID time had been very challenging for us as well. Because the kind of customers we are operating in, we're sitting in India, we are dealing with the customers in US and Europe. And getting new customers, getting new conversation has definitely been a challenge. And the question that you pose is that how do I get my pipeline corrected in such a situation? You know, how do I have an active conversations which I need to do and I need to take them to the conversion phase as well. Okay. Now that is again where having a solid GTM setup really helps out. Okay. So as I said that, you know, we are a traditional manufacturing company and you know we develop fantastic products. But in a Horizon 3 kind of an innovation, we do not have the reach in the food and agri domain. So that is
absolutely
that is where once we want to talk about entering into that area, I need to go in with a partnership kind of a module. I do not have enough salespeople in my respective geographies and they do not have connect because customer connects in the food and agri domain. So how do I solve this problem? So we solve this problem by having this exclusive tie-up with Microsoft. In which the Microsoft already is working with these large food domain giants, okay, and they are providing, they are all on you know AWS cloud and they are consuming it. And the benefit with Microsoft to engage with Bosch and take this new products to their customers is their cloud consumption increases. And
absolutely,
and the customer also values Microsoft by saying that you know you have got me a reputed company. Which can solve my problems. I see value in their product. And let's take this forward. Let's take this together and let's see if we can do this. So now what you see is that how I've been able to solve this, you know, COVID situation and still being able to have a good active communications with my customers is by having a solid partnership with Microsoft, wherein we have been able to reach to their customers, speak to their customers. We understand that the projects are delayed and the priorities have changed, but still we have very good connects and active conversation going. And the last week of January, I believe, second week of January, our pipeline looks healthy and we should be able to kickstart our projects. So partnership has been key for us, that sitting in India, we have been able to still communicate and get an active, healthy pipeline.
Great. Now, brings me to my next question, which is, I presume if you have to get all of this done, you need to have a great team.
Yes.
How do you hire people on your team, Ash?
Okay, great.
What do you look for in them?
You know, I am a very different kind of person when it comes to hiring. Okay.
I'm aware.
So, you know, personally, Sharad, you know, I've been into a lot of innovation kind of a roles, and I see myself going in that direction and developing some new products which have the potential to change the world. Okay. So once you have an ethos of changing the world, you need to you need to have the power to change yourself. To give you an example, you know, I have a filmmaking course, I have a YouTube channel, I have a Udemy course with 3,000 plus students that I teach. So I have a podcast that I do, and you know, I've been into a lot of different sports that I do, and you know, winning a lot of competitions around. So every time the things become monotonous, I ask myself a question: can I do something in which will become which will be a thing that I'll do full time in next 5 years, and try to innovate myself? That gives me the power of innovating at my work life as well, wherein I can look at things in a very different way. And coming from different angles of work. So, you know, I have worked in elevators, I have worked in, you know, air conditioning, I have worked in, you know, weather forecasting, crop insurance, and now working in the cutting edge technologies of IoT blockchain. So working in different domains gives me the power of looking at the world differently, how different industries are trying to solve different problems. So if it comes to hiring a person into the innovation domain or kind of the team that I want, but different people play different roles, but I would look, I look for certain characteristics. So I want a Sehwag in my team, okay, who can hit sixes when it comes to the customer conversations. I need a Rahul Bravin in my team, okay, who can you know, keep my pipeline healthy, continue that customer conversation after the Sehwag is out. I need a spin bowler in my team, so that who can validate new hypothesis, create new dimensions of taking wickets for me. And then I need a Virat Kohli in my team who can manage everything around this. So I'm personally playing the role of Virat Kohli, who manages everything. And then these specific roles I bring in into my team, so that I have a complete team with all the skill sets that they have.
Lovely analogy, Ash. I completely love that. Now, seeing you from afar, I've learned many things. But the one that personally stood out for me was authenticity. You've always communicated what is... You act like a true consultant. And you also try to enable our customer's organization, make the right choices. And I have not seen you just because they don't know you push more money over there. So you're not that kind of a marketing or a sales guy that I've seen. So I've learned authenticity from you. Can you help me understand, why does it pay to sell authentically?
You know, you can, you know, fool someone once, okay? You know, you can.
I get that. Yeah. The old adage of take it till you make it.
Exactly. So you can fool some people sometimes. You can fool some people most of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time. Okay. So that being said, if you want to do a consistent business out there, and if you want to have a personal brand for yourself that people relate to, no matter which organization you are in, the first thing that people look at is there a trustworthy person that I'm interacting with? And trust forms the basis of everything. Okay. So for example, you know, this happened and I was observing this in a restaurant. Okay. So this was a scene. I was sitting on a table. Mm-hmm. And when you enter this restaurant, there is this waiter called Timo. And he's the highest award winning and highest tip getting, you know, waiter in that restaurant. Okay.
Yeah.
So now I was sitting it and it caught my attention that this guy is serving to a group of people who are sitting next to the table. Okay. So there are about 18 youngsters, you know, working professionals, I believe, and they were sitting on a table. And once they sit down, this particular Timo guy comes in and the menu is served. And one of the ladies who starts with, says that, can I have this particular dish? So Timo
right.
Timo looks at it and then, sort of like whispering, but still making sure that everyone hears, says that, madam, this mm-hmm. particular tofu dish that you want to have is generally very, very good in this restaurant. But tonight it's a little mm-hmm. bit shady, and he looks around so that the manager doesn't see him. Okay. And then what he suggests is that there is this dish which is $1 cheaper, but this is fantastic tonight. Okay. Now,
right.
Sharad, what has happened is all of a sudden this Timo guy, okay, from mm-hmm. being a particular waiter has mm-hmm. has become a team member of their group who's trying to suggest a better dish and that to a cheaper. And that is against
yep.
the values of a waiter, where you, if you sell higher, you get better tips, right? Because it's a fixed tip of 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the audience
Correct.
Who's listening to that completely becomes in favor of the Timo. And he says that this guy is actually in my favor. He's trying to save me money and trying to provide me a better dish. So you see, just by having
right.
this particular interaction, the whole group sort of kinds of, depends upon what Timo is suggesting. And now the whole bill,
mm-hmm.
what people are ordering, is into Timo's hand. And he can charge anything. Okay, any dish, any time, just by having this small piece of gesture. So this is
got
this
it,
called
got
a rule
it.
Of reciprocity. If you do something good for the other person, the other person will
mm-hmm.
do the good back to you and little bit extra.
It is basic karma, right?
Yeah.
Like whatever has been told in our traditions, like deep rooted.
Yes.
You do something good, it's gonna come back to you in tenfold.
Exactly.
So I think it's coming back to sales and marketing,
yes,
as well.
Very much.
Yeah. I get
so
get what you're saying.
You need to provide value to true value to your customers, and then the value and the customer will pay you back by saying that I have done this business with him, these guys are true, they do it, and that's what it is. And everything falls down to authenticity over here, Sharad.
True, I get that. And I learned this from you, and I also deployed it when I was interacting with Mimiro. I also deployed this particular principle where I knew kind of guests a month in advance that we were not going to meet our deadlines. And this was not the most crucial time. They had given us a couple of features to build and we had to ship it. But then a month in advance, I knew with all the leads planned by a lot of our developers, QA folks, I knew we were not going to make it. And in the typical most product management style, I could have gone to them and told them on the last day, what, we tried our best, but we could not pull this. But then helping them know or appreciate the decision a month in advance, they came back to me and they told me, we appreciate it.
Mm.
Even we knew that we were not going to make it, but we just wanted to hear it from you guys.
Yeah.
And that kind of blew my
right,
mind.
Exactly, yeah. Because everyone understands the bigness of the problem. What are we trying to solve, and the time it takes to build it. And these are all experienced people in the industry. They're not new. And once
Absolutely.
You and Bosch as a culture has been, to deliver fantastic products and not to ever deliver bad products. Because the bad products are going to
yep.
hurt you later in the life of the product journey. That is why it is important to be the right for the first time, not 100%, but at least 99, 98%.
Mm-hmm.
And then improve upon it or clearly
right.
communicate that, it's going to take time, but once it comes out, you will be amazed.
I completely agree with you. Now, I also wanted to check with you, Ash, because you work with a lot of design teams, engineering, sales and marketing, which is yourself. You also interact a lot with legal teams, quality folks, us product managers. How do you manage the complexity of handling such teams? Because everyone's got their own viewpoints. Everyone's pushing for their own biased viewpoints. How do you pick and choose the right choices and, present it to the customer?
So this is about the internal stakeholder management, sir. Okay. There is one thing. If you're trying to do the right thing, right? Okay. Then
mm-hmm.
everyone is going to come and support you. So that's what I believe. Right. Now,
right.
I know that I'm doing the right thing, but how does the other person who is sitting in front of me, be it a legal, be it or engineering or a project manager, believe me that I am doing the right thing? That is where
Correct.
The storytelling narrative comes in, Sarath. Okay. So now,
mm-hmm.
now in a typical story construct, there is a conflict, there is action, and there is a resolve. So there is a problem, and then
right.
You try to solve the problem by solving, and then the problem gets solved. So thereby mm-hmm. interacting with the internal stakeholders, the intent and the vision that I have has to come out in a storytelling manner. So for example, I need to mm-hmm. get some NDA or a legal work done with a particular entity within my organization. Okay. In order to get mm-hmm. that done, you know, I can just send an email and say that, you know, oh, please look into this because this is a part of your job and you do it. Rather than that, just right. picking up the phone and telling me that, you know, hi, how are you? Getting my repo built up and then telling them that, see, this is the customer. Mm-hmm. The urgency is because we've been working with this customer. And if you help us out, this particular X results will happen. And, you know, the person in front of you yeah. really appreciates that. Saying that, you know, it's just mm-hmm. not an email. It's a personal connect, first of all. Second is the storytelling in which I told him the problem, how the other person is going to act as a hero in that problem and then try to solve the problem for me because there'll be a new world out there. So, you know, if you look at this particular structure, it fits very well into mm-hmm. anyone that you communicate in the world, wherein they understand and they understand and they see they are on your boat now and they want to be a part of your driving factor and your driving success and they want to reach to that goal as well, wherein they want to become a part of that journey.
Right. Understood. Do you also see that with a lot of millennials, we work with a lot of millennials, both you and I. Do you see that as a threat or as an opportunity?
I see that as a big opportunity. But sir, you know, you can't do anything about it even if you, you know, take it as a threat.
No, I think the classic answer is it depends, and we always need to have the experienced people on our team, and yeah, so that's how I go about it. But I wanted to get your perspective. But you put it rightly. You know what? Yeah, you hired them, because hiring is guessing, firing is knowing, but it's not in our hands.
Coming to the new way the world is interacting and living in, Sarath, you know. The millennials are going to play a vital role in shaping up how the organizations work, feel, and behave. Okay. So the attention span has reduced to less than a minute. So in such a scenario where your customers are going to be the millennials and their attention span is too low, you need to be in pace with how the world is behaving. The attention mm-hmm. span of the customers have drastically reduced. So it is less than 1 minute now. And this is the new audience for which you are going to build the products. So it makes mm-hmm. logical sense to have these people on your board, get their perspective, use them as the test users for developing your product. That is why you right. need lots and lots of these millennials and youngsters to be sitting on your board, providing you with what is called a correction feedback loop. Most of mm-hmm, the time, mm-hmm. in innovation, once we work, we tend to get biased about the things that we are doing. Okay, so there is this book which is called, you know, Elephant in the Mind, you know, or mm-hmm. maybe I'm getting it wrong. So it talks about emotional intelligence, and it also talks about the, you know, intelligence all about. So it's, right. it says that, you know, if we want to take a decision, you know, mm-hmm. it's already taken for us. We take the decision and then we bring up certain, you know, examples or try to give us a certain proof saying that the decision that I have taken is correct. Okay.
Correct.
So,
correct.
For example, if you want to buy a car, you've already made up your mind that you're going to buy your car, buy this mm-hmm. particular car. And then once you buy this car, you give yourself reasons. Oh, this car is this feature is good, that feature is good and all that stuff.
Right.
But
right.
you've already
right.
made your decision there. So similarly, okay. you know, So, but that is a very, very wrong thing to do when it comes to innovation, where you always think that you are right.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, you need these next generation people to be coming and telling you that you are wrong over here, mm-hmm. so that you are able to you know, go back, think about it, and then come back and, you know, revalidate your hypothesis before you go into the wrong direction. And the feedback correction loop is, you know, is an extremely critical thing in any part of the life that we perform, wherein sometimes what we think is correct is 100% not correct. And mostly in my case, if I tell you 99 or, you know, not 99, 95% of the time, I'm mostly wrong in whatever I think. Mm. That is why I have to, you know, trust on the other people to provide me that feedback so that I can correct myself and take the right path to move forward.
Absolutely. And I think this ties back to what we spoke earlier, which is also making the decision based on our data. Because now these annual strategic plans or 6-month strategic plans aren't going to work. You have to make the course corrections as you move along, especially when our customers are expecting us to be more agile. They are expecting us to give them or ship products in 2-week span, 3-week span. It's becoming increasingly important to have that back and forth communication with the customer as well. I see a point in what you
exactly. Yes. So you know, the pace, although with pace, it's very important that we do not lose the vision and the direction we are going in.
Completely. Now, I've seen a lot of salespeople or even marketing folks sometimes being a little bullish. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to understand why. And does being a nice guy, or, you know, we talk a lot about emotional intelligence, empathy, kindness, all that. And I've seen a lot of, I've seen you. I've also interacted with 4 or 5 salespeople, at least in Bosch. They're all nice, right? But come what may, when there is a decision to be made, they're always bullish. Or when you have to push certain boundaries, they stop being that nice guy. Does being a nice guy stop you from winning in sales, Ash?
You know, so there are, we all put on different hats, right, on the basis of the situations that we are in. Okay, sir. Okay. So, you know, stitching back to our earlier conversation that I need to make my customer win.
Right.
So like that waiter, I need to be playing in my customer's team, not in the team of the developers and the people who are developing it. Because I know I need to get that repo build up with him. I need to get that value, and I need to provide that value in the you know, best amount of time, best amount of money, so that I can get a long repeat business. So the kind of hat that I put when I'm in front of the customer, then I am not representing that our organization. I am a part and a sort of a family of that particular customer's organization, where I'm adding the value and I'm a bridge between these two organizations.
Right.
But similarly, once you look at a sales guy coming in and you know, giving back the requirements and pushing for the deadlines, it is not that I am you know, I'm a person like that. You know, I am representing the customer in front of you. I am trying to communicate to you what my customer wants, and you know, and then once I look at it, you know, I've got a team who's capable to do it. And then always pushing it forward is, you know, it gets the real cream out. So that's what the idea is, so that, you know, I'm able to keep the best interest of my customer in mind, and I'm also able to get the best out of the people who are developing it for me. And that particular bridge that I'm in between acts as a channel, which is very, very important for the organizational success. So that is all the different hats that we wear, and it leads to organizational success.
Got it. And I'll give you my own example here. I think when I was interacting with some of the sales and marketing folks, what I saw was it helped me push my own boundaries. And it did not make me give any excuses for not doing a particular thing.
Right.
So that's what I learned, because they represent the customer, which is absolutely fine. But they also help you push the boundaries. And as I said, these guys are top-notch guys. They're the most kindest people that I've ever met. But come the situation, they just wear that hat. And it's, for me, it's inexplicable that how can you switch like that. So it's an interesting thing to learn from you, Ash, as well.
Yeah.
Now,
yes, please.
We're nearing the end of the podcast. So I wanted to ask you a stunning question. What is overrated about sales? What is so underrated about it?
Oh, tough question.
Okay. I see you paused a lot there. So,
I need to, and that's why I took a little bit of a pause. And I want to give you, and I'm going to give you a good answer, you know, based on my, you know, about 12 years of sales and marketing and product development experience. Yeah. I think the most overrated thing about sales is that, you know, you are the king in the organization. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's always thought that, you know, the king in the organization are the people who get money. And because they get money, everyone gets paid. Okay. So that's the perception that people have, but that's, you know, I believe is completely wrong, because the kind of pressures that the salespeople have to take is humongous. Okay, and right. And the kind of indoor meetings with the bosses that salespeople have to face, you know, and no matter what the environment is, be it COVID, be it you know, be it rain, be it floods, whatever, the salespeople have to get the revenues in. So it's a tough right. job. So they are not the kings of the organization. So that's one. And, you know, what second is the underrated thing about the salespeople is underrated, I would say, you know, salespeople, you know, mostly make very good leaders as well in the organization. That's what I believe. Because once you understand the, the art of selling, getting the business in, and how the, you know, internal operations work, both in the customer front as well as your organizational front, you sort of get a very broad view of how organization works and how can you take a business to 100 million. So that's underrated, and I don't think so. A lot of people understand this particular thing about sales line, where where the salespeople sort of tend to become very good leaders who can lead the whole organization because you understand the both sides of the coin. So that would be my two cents here, Sarath.
Right. And I've seen this as well pan out in my own experience. I was initially assuming that salespeople are not technical at all. But in my interactions, I've come to realize that they are technically very smart and they're able to make those technology evaluations in conjunction with the business outcomes that you need to manifest as well. So I think technical intelligence, decision intelligence, all these are core part of what you do as well. And that's, in my opinion, is absolutely underrated.
Yeah.
Because what I've seen is people think that sales guys are like, you go sell hard sellers, you pitch and everything. You know, you probably have a go-to-market strategy and everything. But understanding the technology evaluations, that's something that I've seen. It's blew my mind, actually.
Actually, yeah. Very true, sir. Very true, yeah.
Right. So, thank you so much, Ash, for doing this on a weekend. I cannot thank you enough. I truly enjoyed sharing a perspective with you. So any last words that you wanted to say, Ash, before we close up?
It's interesting session, Sarath. You know, I haven't, you know, if someone comes and asks about your sales experience, what you have been doing and what are your thoughts around it, you know, it actually is a good self-reflection upon your experience, what you have had, and also a chance to, what you have learned to communicate it to the audience out there. So in which, you know, this, if you pick up some of the things from this podcast, what you had shared, I had shared, is actually is the real industry experience that we bring in and can help a lot of different people if they just go ahead and implement this into their own life, you know, in sort of shaping their career if they want to move towards the innovation or sales and marketing kind of a field. And overall, Sarath, you know, it was a fantastic experience. Nice set of questions. You know, and I had to pause in a couple of them, you know, just to think about what to respond to. So that's a good thing, you know, and then, you know, really, really nice interacting with you, Sarath.
No, having known you for quite some time, I really enjoyed this conversation with you because I've seen you being on both sides, which is being on the technical front as well, being on the business front as well. So I thought it'll be a good opportunity, at least because we've always interacted when it comes down to what business should we go after or what white space you should we go after. But I've never had a chance to ask you, Ash, how do you go about approaching these things? So that's the reason why I wanted to. It's a little selfish, but I wanted to get Ash's perspective on how he approaches these things.
Happy to help.
Thank you so much, Ash. And I'll see you in 2021 in the office.
Definitely, Sarath. Sure thing. Okay.
Thank you. Right. Bye-bye. Bye.